end of November 1947, 6 months before these Jewish founders became a nation or a civil power, that they were attacked by Arab states who had support from Great Britain. This is why Israel starts their war of independence at this date. Since this time, they've been able to defeat the Arabs time and time again because our Heavenly Father is fighting for them, never to be removed again. Nevertheless, none could say that the Jew has been at peace in the Holy Land since the formation of the Jewish state. Surely Jacob has had trouble in the Holy Land since November 1947. From the JewishVirtualLibrary.org, we have the following quote. Israel's longest war lasted 1 year, 3 months, and 10 days, starting November 30, 1947. The Arab countries signed an armistice agreement with Israel in 1949, starting with Egypt on February 24th, then Lebanon on March 23rd, Jordan on April 3rd, and Syria on July 20th. Iraq was the only country that did not sign an agreement with Israel, choosing instead to withdraw its troops and hand over its sector to Jordan's Arab Legion. What about Israel's armament between 1947 and 1948? Were they a great military power? From Zionism-Israel.com, under the War of Independence, they had this to say. Various sources give somewhat different numbers for Jewish and Arab soldiers and their armament. According to Herzog and Gatzit in their 2005 book, in 1947 there were some 45,000 Haganah troops, but of these only 15,000 could be part of an effective fighting force. The rest were tied to defensive roles. The total armament of the Haganah in 1947 consisted of 900 rifles, 700 light machine guns, and 200 medium machine guns with scarce ammunition, sufficient ammunition for 3 days' fighting. The Haganah had 11 single-engine light civilian aircraft and about 40 pilots, 20 of whom who had some combat experience. There were 350 sailors, but no ships. The Irgun and Lehi, these are other Israeli defense forces, numbered between 2,000 and 4,000 troops, but they had little arms and no combat training. By April of 1948, thanks to clandestine arms acquisitions, but not before, the Haganah had a total of about 20,000 rifles, including Sten guns manufactured in Israel for its 35,000 paper soldiers. There were no tanks or artillery. Armored cars were pickup trucks with a thin layer of sheet metal and plywood. End quote. Furthermore, the dwelling safely of Ezekiel 38 and 8, and also Jeremiah 30 verse 10, had to have occurred before they became a nation, and certainly before they developed one of the most powerful and respected militaries in the world, because in this prophecy they dwelt safely without walls or a civil power. They were without bars and gates, which are the defenses that come with a civil power. After all, none can say that they are dwelling comparatively quietly without walls or civil power now, as the whole world is involved in and focused on the Arab-Jew struggle and has been for the past 69 years. The Jews have a mature, 69-year-old democratic civil power that has been under attack since the day they declared themselves as a nation. The question comes to mind, is it likely the Jew will dwell safely in the future without walls or bars or gates so as to set up the conditions outlined in this prophecy? What would bring a condition that will solve the Arab-Jew issue so that they could dwell peacefully? And furthermore, what would remove their wall or civil power and all their defenses, the bars and gates that are in a wall, and then have this sudden attack by Gog and Magog? Will they give up their weapons and defenses? Are they to cease to be a nation in the future and remove the wall of government that surrounds them? Let's look at Israel's defenses today. And Brother Harry, if you can go to the first figure. So this figure is the weaponry density of Israel This data is from 2006, compared to other nations. From this, we see that they are the most fortified zone on the planet in all categories except one, where they are number two behind North Korea.
And that was missiles,
artillery systems. They have the ability to defend themselves against any enemy, and they've proved it time and time again. A more recent addition to Israeli defenses is the Iron Dome air defense system. On the 10th of March 2012, the Jerusalem Post reported that the system shot down 90% of all rockets launched from Gaza that would have landed in any populated areas. And by November 2012, official statements indicated that it had intercepted over 400 rockets. And then by late October 2014, the Iron Dome system had intercepted 1,200 rockets. Iron Dome is part of a future multi-tiered missile defense system that Israel is developing, which will also include something called Arrow 2, Arrow 3, and David Sling, from as early as 2018. So most certainly, Israel has walls and bars and gates, and they certainly have defenses today. So we have shown that the characteristics of being at peace and dwelling safely, yet at the same time having no walls or bars or gates, had to occur before 1947. Because after 1947, Jacob has been continually at war and continually strengthening the walls and bars and gates, not eliminating them. Item 3, in the latter years. These prophecies all begin their fulfillment during the end of the Gospel Age. Remember, between 1878 and 1914, the Gentile nations were trembling with fear and preparing for war and having war, and Gideon had already broken their pitchers, light was coming out, the Jubilee trumpets were blowing, and the Gentiles were running for the hills. The light of truth was shining, the Jubilee trumpet was blowing, and the church-state system was judged and was going down. Conversely, Israel's double was up, the Jew was back in God's favor. In 1878, the returning of the Jew to Israel had begun as they were able to own land, Jeremiah 30, verse 3. And 3.5 years before the end of the Gospel Age, the great battle of God Almighty began. He was fighting for the Jew as he did in the days of old, and all were in fear as the woman died, that is, the old order died, and as the nation of Israel was born. See Jeremiah 30, verse 6 and 7, and Ezekiel 38, 20 and 21. Item 4. The yoke of Roman rule of Deuteronomy 28, verses 48 through 50, is removed. The Jew was finally able to shed the yoke of Roman or Gentile rule over them and the Holy Land, as already shown. The church, state, Gentile nations were destroyed and the Jew was saved. See Jeremiah 30, verse 11. If we look at the American Standard Version, the Revised Version, and the NIV, Jehovah does not say, "If I will make an end of the nations where I have sent thee," but "I will make a full end of these nations." The Jew would finally have a home to return to, and not just any home, but Jerusalem and the Promised Land. As we've already stated, this is consistent with the destruction of the Midianites out of fear of each other. See Judges 7, verse 22, such that Gideon's little band had them delivered right into their hands. Item 5, the attack from Gog and Magog. After living in relative peace and building the infrastructure of a nation from 1878 clear up to 1947, the chief prince of Meshech and Tubal and his agents, Persia, Ethiopia, and Libya, that is the Muslims of the region, attacked these Jews in November 1947. There were 600,000 Jews facing off with 30 million Arabs, and yet Israel prevailed. However, they lost half of Jerusalem. The defense of Israel is shown in Zechariah's prophecy, but also Jerusalem, remember, was divided. Figure 2, please. Thank you. Figure 2 shows a simple colored map of East and West Jerusalem. The green and blue basically cover the same area. If this division of Jerusalem was the first ever in the history of the city, and the subsequent miraculous victory of the Jew over the Arabs in England was not a fulfillment of Zechariah 14 and 2, then where is such an important event shown in Scripture? Did God ignore these events? Are we to look forward to another bruising of the Jew in their homeland? How could any future wave of anguish bring any more suffering to the Jews than they've already had? We think it could not. Regarding the sixth characteristic, the terrible experiences of the European Jew at the hand of the hunters, where 6 million Jews were sent to the gas chambers. Remember, this happened long after Brother Russell's day. So one more wave of anguish. Certainly, the hunters hunted Israel out of the Gentile nations. But also, the trouble upon Israel when they became a nation. It cost them 1% of their population. 6,000 Jews died in the War of Independence. And they lost half of Jerusalem as well. So we think these six characteristics are fully corroborated in history. But let's look in particular to Gog and Magog. What about Israel's enemy? Soon after the end of World War II and the formation of the United Nations, the world's focus quickly turned to the Jew in Palestine. The UN decided that tensions in the region were too high and imposed a USA-led arms embargo. However, all this embargo did was to strengthen the Arabs and weaken the Jews. An article published in 1979 by the chair of American Studies at Hebrew University in Jerusalem said, quote, "It was common knowledge that even at that very moment, the British were busily engaged in disarming the Haganah forces," that's the Israeli defensive forces, "who were attempting to defend the Jewish community from Arab attacks. Thus, there was little reason to expect that the British would be prepared to provide the Jew with arms. Indeed, the United Kingdom was continuing to ship weapons and supplies to Arab states." The Foreign Office, in reply to an American inquiry, confirmed His Majesty's government, this is a quote from the UK, "His Majesty's government has treaty obligations to supply certain Middle East states with war materials. It is not intended to hold up delivery of such items which form a part of previous orders. Any new orders from Palestine or Arab countries will be scrutinized with great care before it is taken on them. In a subsequent message, the Foreign Office noted, "His Majesty's government is bound to assume that these weapons will not be used contrary to UN Charter." From all this, it is clear that the American policymakers, no less than their British counterparts, realized from the outset that while the arms embargo would profoundly affect the defense capability of the Jewish community, it would at most only marginally affect the Arab states. The latter would continue to receive British supplies in fulfillment of earlier commitments," end quote. So what we get from this quote is that Americans were preventing the Jews from getting arms by putting the arms embargo, and the British were disarming the Jews who had weapons, and the Arabs were receiving weapons and support from their protectors, namely His Majesty's government. In Volume 4, page 556, Brother Russell tells us the following. In Ezekiel's prophecy, chapter 38, verses 1 through 13, the Lord names the chief actors in the struggle in Palestine. But we may not be too positive in our identifications. Magog, Meshech, Tubal, Gomer, Togomar, Haven, and Tarshish were names of children of Noah's son Japheth, supposed to be the original settlers of Europe. End quote. We understand from the comments on Ezekiel 38:5 that Persia, Cush, and Put are the followers of Muhammad, and that they would somehow be associated with Gog and Magog and Gomer and Togarmah, those in the uttermost parts of the north. The scriptures call them in the uttermost parts of the north, and they're descending upon Israel. Also from Ezekiel 38 and 2, we are looking for the chief prince of Rosh, Meshech, and Tubal. This would mean at the time this prophecy would begin fulfillment, Gog and Magog would be the chief of the Europeans. Hopefully the picture is starting to get pretty clear now. Those who have studied history can see that the European power with the greatest ties to Persia, Kush, and Put, and the greatest influence over the Holy Land was the United Kingdom. The UK at the time this prophecy begins was the most powerful European nation, the chief prince of the Europeans. Let's take a closer look at the UK and better understand the events that led from the Berlin Congress of Nations and the Balfour Declaration and the support they had for the Zionist movement to the condition where the British were fighting on the side of the Arabs, supplying arms, ammunition, fighters, and restricting immigration to extinguish all hope for this incipient Jewish state. Most Bible students are familiar with the events on the veranda of the Bismarck's Chancellery at the Berlin Congress of Nations and the clear words of the Balfour Declaration showing British support of the Zionist movement. These had all happened in Brother Russell's day. However, most are not familiar with the decline of this support, beginning with the British White Papers written to benefit Arabs. This decline in national support culminated in British soldiers firing on the ship the Exodus in 1947, and His Majesty's government supplying arms and other resources to the enemies of the Jews, while at the same time disarming Jewish resistance. These things happened alongside the arms embargo in the region imposed by the USA, essentially preventing the Jews' ability to obtain weapons and ammunition, while the Arabs had a free flow of weapons thanks to Great Britain. You know, the Lord was going to make sure nobody got the credit but Him for this miracle. It wasn't going to be the USA getting the credit. Britain wasn't going to. Nobody but the Lord would get credit. I think this is why the Lord made it so difficult for the Jews to get weapons. Due to ongoing unrest from Britain's Arab occupiers and their renewed desire to have access to Arab oil at the expense of the European Jews, a 1939 white paper was written which provided even more restrictions on Jewish immigration and a clarification of the Balfour Declaration. So they need to clarify that. Here's key excerpts from 1939 white paper written to satisfy Arab concerns. It reads, "The objective of His Majesty's government is the establishment within 10 years of an independent Palestinian state in such treaty relations with the United Kingdom as will provide satisfactorily for the commercial and strategic requirements of both countries in the future. The proposal for the establishment of the independent state would involve consultation with the Council of the League of Nations with a view to the termination of the mandate. The independent state should be one in which Arabs and Jews share government in such a way as to ensure that the essential interests of each of their communities are safeguarded. Arab and Jewish representatives will be invited to serve as heads of departments, approximately in proportion to their respective populations. The number of Palestinians in charge of departments will be increased as circumstances permit, until all heads of departments are Palestinians, exercising the administrative and advisory functions which are presently performed by British officials. If immigration has an adverse effect on the economic position in the country, it should clearly be restricted. And equally, if it has seriously damaging effect on the political position in the country, that's a factor that shall not be ignored. Although it is not difficult to contend that the large number of Jewish immigrants who have been admitted so far have been absorbed economically, the fear of the Arabs that this influx will continue indefinitely until a Jewish population is in a position to dominate them has produced consequences which are extremely grave for Jews and Arabs alike and for the peace and prosperity of Palestine. Jewish immigration during the next 5 years will be at a rate which, if economic absorptive capacity permits, will bring the Jewish population up to approximately one-third of the total population of the country. taking into account the expected natural increase of Arab and Jewish population and the number of illegal Jewish immigrants now in the country, this would allow the admission, as far from the beginning of April this year, some 75,000 immigrants over the next 5 years. These immigrants would, subject to the criterion of economic absorptive capacity, be admitted as follows. For each of the next 5 years, a quota of 10,000 Jewish immigrants will be allowed, on the understanding that a shortage 1 year may be added to the quota for a subsequent year within this five-year period, if economic absorptive capacity permits. After the period of 5 years, no further Jewish immigration will be permitted unless the Arabs of Palestine are prepared to acquiesce. His Majesty's government are determined to check illegal immigration and further preventative measures are being adopted. The numbers of any Jewish illegal immigrants who, despite these measures, may succeed in getting into the country and cannot be deported will be deducted from the yearly quotas. End quote. So, 600,000 Jews, maximum of 675,000 Jews, roughly one-third of the population, seems pretty unfair, right? The Jews would have one-third to say, Palestinians would have two-thirds. Think the Lord was going to have any of that?
Nope.
So, His Majesty's government decided to throw their support behind the Arabs and sacrifice the Jew. This support was primarily motivated by the desire to control Arab oil discovered during this time from 1914 to 1948. Israel's lover had forsaken her. England had pledged to be her lover. And as this fragile, newborn government of Israel fought for its life against the British and their Arab agents, the rest of the world just watched. It is often thought that the U.S. was an ardent supporter of the Jews in Palestine at this time. However, not only did the USA not help the Jew, we actually prevented them from getting weapons and armament. Although Truman was a great supporter of the Jews, there was a great political battle raging between Truman and his State Department, which was headed up by George Marshall. From a book of the memoirs of Clark Gifford with Richard Holbrooke, the first chapter is titled Showdown in the Oval Office. The book was published in 1991. It says, quote, Marshall firmly opposed American recognition of the new Jewish state. I did not. Marshall's opposition was shared by almost every member of the brilliant and now legendary group of men later referred to as the Wise Men, who were then in the process of creating a post-war foreign policy that would endure for more than 40 years. The opposition included the respected Under Secretary of State Bob Lovett, his predecessor Dean Acheson, the number three man in the State Department Charles Bolin, the brilliant chief of the policy planning staff, George F. Keenan, the dynamic and driven Secretary of Defense, James Forrestal, and a man with whom I would disagree again 20 years later when we served together in the cabinet, Dean Rusk, then the director of the Office of United Nations Affairs. Some months earlier, during one of our weekly breakfasts at his elegant Georgetown home, Forrestal had spoken emotionally and frankly to me concerning his opposition to help the Zionists, as advocates of the creation of a Jewish state were called. He said, "You fellows over at the White House are just not facing up to the realities in the Middle East. There are 30 million Arabs on one side and about 600,000 Jews on the other. It is clear that in any contest, the Arabs are going to overwhelm the Jews. Why don't you face up to the realities? Just look at the numbers." "Jim, the president knows just as well as you do what the numbers are," I replied. "But he doesn't consider this to be a question of numbers. He's always supported the right of the Jews to have their own homeland, from the moment he became president. He considered this to be a question about the moral and ethical considerations that are present in that part of the world. For that reason, he supports the foundation of a Jewish state. He is sympathetic to their needs and their desires, and I assure you he's going to continue to lend our country's support to the creation of a Jewish state." Forrestal answered bluntly, "Well, if he does that, then he's absolutely dead wrong." His attitude was typical of the foreign policy establishment, especially the pro-Arab professionals at the State Department, who, deeply influenced by the huge oil reserves in the Mideast, supported the side they thought would be the likely winner in the struggle between Arabs and the Jews. Officials in the State Department had done everything in their power to prevent, thwart, or delay the president's Palestine policy in 1947 and in 1948, while I was fighting for assistance to this Jewish agency. Watching the State Department find various ways to avoid carrying out White House instructions, I sometimes felt almost bitterly that they preferred to follow the views of the British Foreign Office rather than those of their president. End quote. On May 15, 1948, one day after the declaration of its establishment, Israel applied for membership of the United Nations, but the application was not acted on by the Security Council. Israel's second application was rejected by the Security Council on the 17th of December, 1948. The application was renewed in 1949 after the armistice was signed with Egypt, Jordan, and Lebanon, and after Israeli elections. Finally, the Security Council on the 4th of March, 1949, voted 9-1 in favor of membership, with Egypt voting no, Great Britain abstaining. It makes one wonder how a country like Great Britain could go from Zionist's greatest supporter in 1878 to abstaining from voting in favor of their acceptance as a nation in 1949. So hopefully the next slide will seal the deal here. To further cement Great Britain as the key actor in this prophecy, we will look at the historic defenders of the City of London. Their names, Gog and Magog. The following is from an article about the Lord Mayor's Day Parade in London. Quote, towards the head of the procession for the Lord Mayor's Day Parade, you will see two stern but benevolent wicker giants. They are Gog and Magog, the traditional guardians of the City of London. And they have been carried in the Lord Mayor's Day show since the reign of Henry V. Gog and Magog, or sometimes Gog, Magog, and Quirinius, are descended from the pagan giants of early English pageantry, and their origins lie in ancient legends of Britain's beginning. End quote. Another reference on the same subject says, quote, the procession starts at Guildhall and consists of hundreds of floats, horses, people, bands, and more, all celebrating hundreds of years of London history. At the head of the parade are the two wicker giants representing Gog and Magog, supposed guardians of the City of London. Two smaller versions of Gog and Magog stand permanently on display inside the Guildhall itself, but the wicker ones march to Westminster at the head of the parade. End quote. In Greenfield Village in Dearborn, Michigan, there's a store called Sir John's Bennett's Sweet Shop, where you can find Gog and Magog atop of the store, ready to ring the clock chimes. I remember seeing this and thinking, Gog and Magog, huh? Like, what a, you know, where'd that come from? Kind of led us down this path of investigating this further. This store is a replica of the original shop in London, which stood five stories tall and provides another proof of the prominence of Gog and Magog in British folklore. For further information on this subject, you can go to LordsMayorsDayShow.London and look in. Just look up Lord's Mayor's Day Show. You will get all these. So our claim is that Great Britain was the Gog and Magog of Ezekiel 38. Does it fit the description? 1. Gog and Magog was the chief prince of Meshech and Tubal. Meshech and Tubal are the ancestral fathers of those who settled in Europe. Volume 4, page 556. The chief prince of Europe at the time of Israel's regathering to their land from 1878 to 1948 was England. Remember, the sun never set on the English Empire, whose commonwealth extended across all time zones until the World War II, basically. England was made a protectorate of Palestine, the most prominent power in the area. At first, they claimed to be the friend of the Jew. However, once the oil, that is the hooks in the jaws of Ezekiel 38, verse 4, was discovered throughout the Arab world, England began to secretly turn against the Jew and favor the Arab, as already presented in the British White Paper of 1939, just in time for Hitler's extermination of the Jews. Also read about the ship, the Exodus, in 1947 and the experiences of these poor European Jews at the hand of the British. Persia, Ethiopia, Libya represented all the Arabs and Muslims who would be fighting with Gog and Magog against the Jew. As already presented, between 1945 and 1948, England armed the Arab League through secret arms sales to Iraq, despite the arms embargo in Palestine. See the book O Jerusalem, page 150. So the Jews were being disarmed by England and not allowed to buy arms by the Americans, but the Arabs were able to get all the arms they wanted with England's help. So, for me, that cements them as the ones supporting the chief actors of Gog and Magog. In summary, we have presented what appeals to us as a fulfillment of Ezekiel 38, 8 through 12, Jeremiah 32 through 11, and Zechariah 14, 1 through 3, during the period from 1914 through 1949. The fact that Israel is no longer under the yoke of Gentile control, that the Jew is no longer living in peace without walls, bars, and gates, and the fact that England played such a central role in the region and had as their capital city guardians, Gog and Magog, and the fact that Jerusalem was divided in 1948, are all events which fit every prophetic description, and I think cannot be ignored. These conditions would be impossible to replicate in the future, as Israel has already returned to their captivity, their former state of prosperity. They've already shed themselves the yoke of Gentile bondage, and Jerusalem has already been divided. How could these ever be repeated? Is the Jew to be placed back under Gentile rule so that they may be freed in the future? Or is Israel to be dispersed and then returned to their land again? Will the Jew remove their walls, bars, and gates, and all their universally admired state-of-the-art defenses just to tempt Gog to plunder them in the future? We answer no to all these questions. Our king is marching on. He has continued to fulfill prophecy and to bring his kingdom with greater precision and with greater care for the suffering world of mankind than before thought possible. It's being brought in almost solely by the power of the truth on all subjects. And may the Lord add his blessing.
Thank you, Brother Keith.